Hardin replied lightly. Yes, the cruiser I myself ordered repaired, but in my own way. Tell me, Weenus, have you ever heard of an ultra-wave relay? No, I see you haven't. Well, in about 2 minutes, you'll find out what one can do. The televisor flashed to life as he spoke, and he amended, No, in 2 seconds. Sit down, Weenus, and listen. 7. Theo Apparat was one of the very highest-ranking priests of Anacreon. From the standpoint of precedence alone, he deserved his appointment as head priest attendant upon the flagship Weenus. But it was not only rank or precedence. He knew the ship. He had worked directly under the holy men from the Foundation itself in repairing the ship. He had gone over the motors under their orders. He had rewired the visors, revamped the communication system, replated the punctured hull, reinforced the beams. He had even been permitted to help while the wise men of the Foundation had installed a device so holy it had never been placed in any previous ship, but had been reserved only for this magnificent colossus of a vessel, the ultra-wave relay. It was no wonder that he felt heartsick over the purposes to which the glorious ship was perverted. He had never wanted to believe what Barisov had told him, that the ship was to be used for appalling wickedness, that its guns were to be turned on the great Foundation. Turned on that Foundation where he had been trained as a youth, from which all blessedness was derived. Yet he could not doubt now after what the Admiral had told him. How could the King, divinely blessed, allow this abominable act? Or was it the King? Was it not perhaps an action of the accursed Regent Weenus, without the knowledge of the King at all? And it was the son of this same Weenus that was the Admiral who 5 minutes before had told him, Attend to your souls and your blessings, priest. I will attend to my ship. Apparat smiled crookedly. He would attend to his souls and his blessings, and also to his cursings, and Prince Lefkin would whine soon enough. He had entered the general communications room now. His acolyte preceded him, and the two officers in charge made no move to interfere. The head priest attendant had the right of free entry anywhere on the ship. Close the door, Apparat ordered, and looked at the chronometer. It lacked 12:05. He had timed it well. With quick, practiced motions, he moved the little levers that opened all communications, so that every part of the 2-mile-long ship was within reach of his voice and his image. Soldiers of the Royal Flagship Venus, attend. It is your priest attendant that speaks. The sound of his voice reverberated, he knew, from the stern atom blast in the extreme rear to the navigation tables in the prow. Your ship, he cried, is engaged in sacrilege. Without your knowledge, it is performing such an act as will doom the soul of every man among you to the eternal frigidity of space. Listen, it is the intention of your commander to take this ship to the Foundation, and there to bombard that source of all blessings into submission to his sinful will. And since that is his intention, I, in the name of the Galactic Spirit, remove him from his command, for there is no command where the blessing of the Galactic Spirit has been withdrawn. The Divine King himself may not maintain his kingship without the consent of the Spirit. His voice took on a deeper tone while the acolyte listened with veneration and the two soldiers with mounting fear. And because this ship is upon such a devil's errand, the blessing of the Spirit is removed from it as well. He lifted his arms solemnly, and before 1,000 televisors throughout the ship, soldiers cowered as the stately image of their priest attendant spoke. In the name of the Galactic Spirit and of his prophet Harry Seldon, and of his interpreters, the holy men of the Foundation, I curse this ship. Let the televisors of this ship, which are its eyes, become blind. Let its grapples, which are its arms, be paralyzed. Let the atom blasts, which are its fists, lose their function. Let the motors, which are its heart, cease to beat. Let the communications, which are its voice, become dumb. Let its ventilations, which are its breath, fade. Let its lights, which are its soul, shrivel into nothing. In the name of the Galactic Spirit, I so curse this ship. And with his last word, at the stroke of midnight, a hand, light years distant in the Argolid Temple, opened an ultra-wave relay, which, at the instantaneous speed of the ultra-wave, opened another on the flagship Venus. And the ship died. For it is the chief characteristic of the religion of science that it works, and that such curses as that of Apparat's are really deadly. Apparat saw the darkness close down on the ship and heard the sudden ceasing of the soft, distant purring of the hyperatomic motors. He exulted, and from the pocket of his long robe withdrew a self-powered atomo bulb that filled the room with pearly light. He looked down at the two soldiers, who, brave men though they undoubtedly were, writhed on their knees in the last extremity of mortal terror. "Save our souls, your reverence. We are poor men, ignorant of the crimes of our leaders," one whimpered. "Follow," said Apparat sternly. "Your soul is not yet lost." The ship was a turmoil of darkness in which fear was so thick and palpable it was all but a miasmic smell. Soldiers crowded close wherever Apparat in his circle of light passed, striving to touch the hem of his robe, pleading for the tiniest scrap of mercy. And always his answer was, "Follow me." He found Prince Lefkin groping his way through the officers' quarters, cursing loudly for lights. The admiral stared at the priest attendant with hating eyes. "There you are." Lefkin inherited his blue eyes from his mother, but there was that about the hook in his nose and the squint in his eye that marked him as the son of Venus. "What is the meaning of your treasonable actions? Return the power to the ship. I am commander here."
"No longer," said Apparat somberly.
Lefkin looked about wildly. "Seize that man. Arrest him, or by space I will send every man within reach of my voice out the airlock in the Nude." He paused and then shrieked, "It is your admiral that orders. Arrest him!" Then, as he lost his head entirely, "Are you allowing yourselves to be fooled by this mountebank, this harlequin? Do you cringe before a religion compounded of clouds and moonbeams? This man is an impostor, and the galactic spirit he speaks of, a fraud of the imagination devised to—"
Apparat interrupted furiously. "Seize the blasphemer. You listen to him at the peril of your souls."
And promptly the noble admiral went down under the clutching hands of a score of soldiers.
"Take him with you and follow me."
Apparat turned, and with Lefkin dragged along after him and the corridors behind black with soldiery, he returned to the communications room. There he ordered the ex-commander before the one televisor that worked. "Order the rest of the fleet to seize course and prepare for the return to Anacreon." The disheveled Lefkin, bleeding, beaten, and half-stunned, did so. "And now," continued Apparat grimly, "we are in contact with Anacreon and the ultra-wave beam. Speak as I order you." Lefkin made a gesture of negation, and the mob in the room, and the others crowding the corridor beyond, growled fearfully. "Speak," said Apparat. "Begin."
"The Anacreonian Navy—"
Lefkin began. 8. There was absolute silence in Venus Chambers when the image of Prince Lefkin appeared at the televisor. There had been one startled gasp from the regent at the haggard face and shredded uniform of his son. Then he collapsed into a chair, face contorted with surprise and apprehension. Hardin listened stolidly, hands clasped lightly in his lap, while the just-crowned King Leopold sat shriveled in the most shadowy corner, biting spasmodically at his gold-braided sleeve. Even the soldiers had lost the emotionless stare that is the prerogative of the military, and from where they lined up against the door, atom blasts ready, peered furtively at the figure upon the televisor. Lefkin spoke, reluctantly, with a tired voice that paused at intervals as though he were being prompted, and not gently. "The Anacreonian Navy, aware of the nature of its mission, and refusing to be a party to abominable sacrilege, is returning to Anacreon with the following ultimatum issued. To those blaspheming sinners who would dare to use profane force against the Foundation, source of all blessings, and against the galactic spirit, cease at once all war against the true faith, and guarantee in a manner suiting us of the Navy, as represented by our priest attendant Theo Apparat, that such war will never, in the future, be resumed, and that—" Here a long pause, and then continuing— "and that the one-time Prince Regent Venus be imprisoned and tried before an ecclesiastical court for his crimes. Otherwise, the Royal Navy, upon returning to Anacreon, will blast the palace to the ground and take whatever other measures are necessary to destroy the nest of sinners and the den of destroyers of men's souls that now prevail." The voice ended with half a sob, and the screen went blank. Hardin's fingers passed rapidly over the atomo bulb, and its light faded until, in the dimness, the hitherto regent, the king, and the soldiers were hazy-edged shadows, and for the first time it could be seen that an aura encompassed Hardin. It was not the blazing light that was the prerogative of kings, but one less spectacular, less impressive, and yet one more effective in its own way, and more useful. Hardin's voice was softly ironic as he addressed the same Venus who had, 1 hour earlier, declared him a prisoner of war and Terminus on the point of destruction, and who now was a huddled shadow, broken and silent. "There is an old fable," said Hardin, "as old, perhaps, as humanity, for the oldest records containing it are merely copies of other records still older that might interest you. It runs as follows. A horse, having a wolf as a powerful and dangerous enemy, lived in constant fear of his life. Being driven to desperation, it occurred to him to seek a strong ally. Whereupon he approached a man and offered an alliance, pointing out that the wolf was likewise an enemy of the man. The man accepted the partnership at once and offered to kill the wolf immediately if his new partner would only cooperate by placing his greater speed at the man's disposal. The horse was willing and allowed the man to place bridle and saddle upon him. The man mounted, hunted down the wolf, and killed him. The horse, joyful and relieved, thanked the man and said, "Now that our enemy is dead, remove your bridle and saddle and restore my freedom." Whereupon the man laughed loudly and replied, "The hell you say, giddy-up, Dobbin," and applied the spurs with a will. Silence still. The shadow that was Weenus did not stir. Hardin continued quietly. You see the analogy, I hope. In their anxiety to cement forever total domination over their own people, the kings of the four kingdoms accepted the religion of science that made them divine, and that same religion of science was their bridle and saddle, for it placed the lifeblood of atomic power in the hands of the priesthood, who took their orders from us, be it noted, and not from you. You killed the wolf, but could not get rid of them. Weenus sprang to his feet, and in the shadows his eyes were maddened hollows. His voice was thick, incoherent.
Yes, I'll get you. You won't escape. You'll rot. Let them blow us up. Let them blow everything up. You'll rot. I'll get you. Soldiers, he thundered hysterically. Shoot me down, that devil. Blast him. Blast him.
Hardin turned about in his chair to face the soldiers and smiled. One aimed his atom blast and then lowered it. The others never budged. Salber Hardin, mayor of Terminus, surrounded by that soft aura, smiling so confidently, and before whom all the power of Anacreon had crumbled to powder, was too much for them, despite the orders of the shrieking maniac just beyond. Weenus screamed a curse and staggered to the nearest soldier. Wildly he wrested the atom blast from the man's hand, aimed it at Hardin, who didn't stir, shoved the lever, and held it contacted. The pale, continuous beam impinged upon the force field that surrounded the mayor of Terminus, and was sucked harmlessly to neutralization. Weenus pressed harder and laughed tearingly. Hardin still smiled, and his force field aura scarcely brightened as it absorbed the energies of the atom blast. From his corner, Leppold covered his eyes and moaned. And with a yell of despair, Weenus changed his aim and shot again, and toppled to the floor with his head blown into nothingness. Hardin winced at the sight and muttered, "A man of direct action to the end. The last refuge." 9. The time vault was filled far beyond the available seating capacity, and men lined the back of the room three deep. Salver Hardin compared this large company with the few men attending the first appearance of Harry Seldon 30 years earlier. There had only been 6 then, the 5 old encyclopedists, all dead now, and himself, the young figurehead of a mayor. It had been on that day that he, with Johann Lee's assistance, had removed the figurehead stigma from his office. It was quite different now, different in every respect. Every man of the city council was awaiting Seldon's appearance. He himself was still mayor, but all-powerful now, and since the utter rout of Anacreon, all-popular. When he had returned from Anacreon with the news of the death of Weenus and the new treaty signed with the trembling Leppold, he was greeted with a vote of confidence of shrieking unanimity. When this was followed in rapid order by similar treaties signed with each of the other 3 kingdoms, treaties that gave the Foundation powers such as would forever prevent any attempts at attack similar to that of Anacreon's, torchlight processions had been held in every city street of Terminus. Not even Harry Seldon's name had been more loudly cheered. Hardin's lips twitched. Such popularity had been his after the first crisis also. Across the room, Seth Cermak and Louis Bort were engaged in animated discussion, and recent events seemed to have put them out not at all. They had joined in the vote of confidence, made speeches in which they publicly admitted that they had been in the wrong, apologized handsomely for the use of certain phrases in earlier debates, excused themselves delicately by declaring they had merely followed the dictates of their judgment and their conscience, and immediately launched a new actionist campaign. Johann Lee touched Hardin's sleeve and pointed significantly to his watch. Hardin looked up. "Hello there, Lee. Are you still sour? What's wrong now?"
"He's due in 5 minutes, isn't he?"
"I presume so. He appeared at noon last time."
"What if he doesn't?"
"Are you going to wear me down with your worries all your life? If he doesn't, he won't." Lee frowned and shook his head slowly.
"If this thing flops, we're in another mess. Without Seldon's backing for what we've done, Cermak will be free to start all over. He wants outright annexation of the Four Kingdoms and immediate expansion of the Foundation, by force if necessary. He's begun his campaign already.
I know. A fire-eater must eat fire even if he has to kindle it himself. And you, Lee, have got to worry, even if you must kill yourself to invent something to worry about. Lee would have answered, but he lost his breath at just that moment, as the lights yellowed and went dim. He raised his arm to point to the glass cubicle that dominated half the room, and then collapsed into a chair with a windy sigh. Hardin himself straightened at the sight of the figure that now filled the cubicle, a figure in a wheelchair. He alone, of all those present, could remember the day, decades ago, when that figure had appeared first. He had been young then, and the figure old. Since then, the figure had not aged a day, but he himself had in turn grown old. The figure stared straight ahead, hands fingering a book in its lap. It said, "I am Harry Selden." The voice was old and soft. There was a breathless silence in the room, and Harry Selden continued conversationally. "This is the second time I've been here. Of course, I don't know if any of you were here the first time. In fact, I have no way of telling by sense perception that there is anyone here at all, but that doesn't matter. If the second crisis has been overcome safely, you are bound to be here. There is no way out. If you are not here, then the second crisis has been too much for you." He smiled engagingly. "I doubt that, however, for my figures show a 98.4% probability there is to be no significant deviation from the plan in the first 80 years. According to our calculations, you have now reached domination of the barbarian kingdoms immediately surrounding the Foundation. Just as in the first crisis you held them off by the use of the balance of power, so in the second you gained mastery by the use of the spiritual power as against the temporal. However, I might warn you here against overconfidence. It is not my way to grant you any foreknowledge in these recordings, but it would be safe to indicate that what you have now achieved is merely a new balance, the one in which your position is considerably better. The spiritual power, while sufficient to ward off attacks of the temporal, is not sufficient to attack in turn. Because of the invariable growth of the counteracting force known as regionalism or nationalism, the spiritual power cannot prevail. I'm telling you nothing new, I'm sure. You must pardon me, by the way, for speaking to you in this vague way. The terms I used are at best mere approximations, but none of you is qualified to understand the true symbology of psychohistory, and so I must do the best I can. In this case, the Foundation is only at the start of the path that leads to new empire. The neighboring kingdoms, in manpower and resources, are still overwhelmingly powerful as compared to yourselves. Outside them lies the vast, tangled jungle of barbarism that extends around the entire breadth of the galaxy. Within that rim, there is still what is left of the Galactic Empire, and that, weakened and decaying though it is still incomparably mighty. At this point, Harry Selden lifted his book and opened it. His face grew solemn. "And never forget, there was another Foundation established 80 years ago, a Foundation at the other end of the galaxy, at Star's End. They will always be there for consideration. Gentlemen, 920 years of the plan stretch ahead of you. The problem is yours. Go to it." He dropped his eyes to his book and flicked out of existence, while the lights brightened to fullness. In the babble that followed, Lee leaned over to Hardin's ear.
"He didn't say when he'd be back."
Hardin replied, "I know, but I trust that he won't return until you and I are safely and cozily dead." Part 4. The Traitors. 1. Traitors. And constantly in advance of the political hegemony of the Foundation were the traitors, reaching out tenuous finger holds through the tremendous distances of the periphery. Months or years might pass between landings on Terminus. Their ships were often nothing more than patch quilts of homemade repairs and improvisations. Their honesty was none of the highest. Their daring... Through it all, they forged an empire more enduring than the pseudo-religious despotism of the Four Kingdoms. Tales without end are told of these massive, lonely figures who bore half-seriously, half-mockingly, a motto adopted from one of Salvar Hardin's epigrams: "Never let your sense of morals prevent you from doing what is right." It is difficult now to tell which tales are real and which apocryphal. There are none, probably, that have not suffered some exaggeration. Encyclopedia Galactica. Limmer Ponyitz was completely alather when the call reached his receiver. which proves that the old bromide about telemessages in the bathtub holds true even in the dark, hard space of the galactic periphery. Luckily, that part of a freelance trade ship which is not given over to miscellaneous merchandise is extremely snug, so much so that the shower, hot water included, is located in a 2x4 cubby 10 feet from the control panels. Ponyets heard the staccato rattle of the receiver quite plainly. Dripping suds and a curse, he stepped out to adjust the vocal, and 3 hours later a second trade ship was alongside, and a grinning youngster entered through the air tube between the ships. Ponyets rattled his best chair forward and perched himself on the pilot's wheel. "What have you been doing, Gorm?" he asked darkly. "Chasing me all the way from the Foundation?" Les Gorm broke out a cigarette and shook his head definitely. "Me? Not a chance. I'm just the sucker who happened to land on Gliptol 4 the day after the mail. So they sent me out after you with this." The tiny, gleaming sphere changed hands, and Gorm added, "It's confidential. Super secret. Can't be trusted to the sub-ether and all that, or so I gather. At least it's a personal capsule and won't open for anyone but you." Ponyets regarded the capsule distastefully. "I can see that, and I never knew one of these to hold good news, either." It opened in his hand, and the thin, transparent tape unrolled stiffly. His eyes swept the message quickly, for when the last of the tape had emerged, the first was already brown and crinkled. In a minute and a half it had turned black, and molecule by molecule fallen apart. Ponyets grunted hollowly. "Oh, galaxy." Les Gorm said quietly, "Can I help somehow, or is it too secret?" "It'll bear telling, since you're of the Guild. I've got to go to Ascone." "That place? How come?" "They've imprisoned a traitor, but keep it to yourself." Gorm's expression jolted into anger. "Imprisoned? That's against the convention." "So was interference with local politics." "Oh, is that what he did?" Gorm meditated. "Who's the traitor? Anyone I know?" "No," said Ponyets sharply, and Gorm accepted the implication and asked no further questions. Ponyets was up and staring darkly out the visiplate. He mumbled strong expressions at that part of the misty lens form that was the body of the galaxy, then said loudly, "Damnedest mess. I'm way behind quota." Light broke on Gorm's intellect. "Hey, friend, Ascone's a closed area." "That's right. You can't sell as much as a penknife on Ascone. They won't buy atomic gadgets of any sort. With my quota dead on its feet, it's murder to go there." "Can't get out of it?" Ponyets shook his head absently. "I know the fellow involved. Can't walk out on a friend. What of it? I am in the hands of the galactic spirit and walk cheerfully in the way he points out." Gorm said blankly, "Huh?" Ponyets looked at him and laughed shortly. "I forgot. You never read the Book of the Spirit, did you?" "Never heard of it," said Gorm curtly. "Well, you would if you'd had a religious training." "Religious training? For the priesthood?" Gorm was profoundly shocked. "Afraid so. It's my dark shame and secret. I was too much for the revered fathers, though. They expelled me for reasons sufficient to promote me to a secular education under the Foundation." "Well, look, I'd better push off. How's your quota this year?" Gorm crushed out his cigarette and adjusted his cap. "I've got my last cargo going now. I'll make it." "Lucky fellow," gloomed Ponyets, and for many minutes after Les Gorm left, he sat in a motionless reverie. So Eskil Gorov was on Ascone, and in prison as well. That was bad. In fact, considerably worse than it might appear. It was one thing to tell a curious youngster a diluted version of the business to throw him off and send him about his own. It was a thing of a different sort to face the truth. For Limar Ponyets was one of the few people who happened to know that Master Trader Eskil Gorov was not a traitor at all, but that entirely different thing, an agent of the Foundation. 2 weeks gone, 2 weeks wasted. 1 week to reach Ascone, at the extreme borders of which the vigilant warships speared out to meet him in converging numbers. Whatever their detection system was, it worked, and well. They sidled him in slowly, without a signal, maintaining their cold distance, and pointing him harshly towards the central sun of Ascone. Ponyets could have handled them at a pinch. Those ships were holdovers from the dead-and-gone Galactic Empire, but they were sports cruisers, not warships, and without atomic weapons, they were so many picturesque and impotent ellipsoids. But Eskil Gorov was a prisoner in their hands, and Gorov was not a hostage to lose. The Asconians must know that. And then another week. A week to wind a weary way through the clouds of minor officials that formed the buffer between the Grand Master and the outer world. Each little subsecretary required soothing and conciliation. Each required careful and nauseating milking for the flourishing signature that was the pathway to the next official, one higher up. For the first time, Ponyets found his trader's identification papers useless. Now, at last, the Grand Master was on the other side of the guard-flanked gilded door, and 2 weeks had gone. Gorov was still a prisoner, and Ponyet's cargo rotted useless in the holds of his ship. The Grand Master was a small man with a balding head and very wrinkled face, whose body seemed weighed down to motionlessness by the huge glossy fur collar about his neck. His fingers moved on either side, and the line of armed men backed away to form a passage, along which Ponyet strode to the foot of the chair of state. "Don't speak," snapped the Grand Master, and Ponyet's opening lips closed tightly. "That's right," the Asconian ruler relaxed visibly. "I can't endure useless chatter. You cannot threaten, and I won't abide flattery. Nor is there room for injured complaints. I have lost count of the times you wanderers have been warned that your devil's machines are not wanted anywhere in Ascone."
"Sir," said Ponyet quietly, "there is no attempt to justify the trader in question. It is not the policy of traders to intrude where they are not wanted. But the galaxy is great, and it has happened before that a boundary has been trespassed unwittingly. It was a deplorable mistake."
"Deplorable, certainly," squeaked the Grand Master. "But mistake? Your people on Gliptol 4 have been bombarding me with pleas for negotiation since 2 hours after the sacrilegious wretch was seized. I have been warned by them of your own coming many times over. It seems a well-organized rescue campaign. Much seems to have been anticipated, a little too much for mistakes, deplorable or otherwise."
The Asconian's black eyes were scornful. He raced on. "And are you traitors, flitting from world to world like mad little butterflies, so mad in your own right that you can land on Ascone's largest world, in the center of its system, and consider it an unwitting boundary mix-up? Come, surely not."
Ponyet winced without showing it. He said doggedly, "If the attempt to trade was deliberate, Your Veneration, it was most injudicious and contrary to the strictest regulations of our guild."
"Injudicious, yes," said the Asconian curtly. "So much so that your comrade is likely to lose life in payment."
Ponyet's stomach knotted. There was no irresolution there. He said, "Death, Your Veneration, is so absolute and irrevocable a phenomenon that certainly there must be some alternative." There was a pause before the guarded answer came.
"I have heard that the Foundation is rich."
"Rich, certainly. But our riches are that which you refuse to take.
Our atomic goods are worth... Your goods are worthless in that they lack the ancestral blessing. Your goods are wicked and accursed in that they lie under the ancestral interdict."
The sentences were intoned, the recitation of a formula. The Grand Master's eyelids dropped, and he said with meaning,
"You have nothing else of value?"
The meaning was lost on the trader.
"I don't understand. What is it you want?"
The Asconian's hand spread apart.
"You ask me to trade places with you and make known to you my wants. I think not. Your colleague, it seems, must suffer the punishment set for sacrilege by the Asconian code, death by gas. We are a just people. The poorest peasant in like case would suffer no more. I myself would suffer no less."
Ponyet mumbled hopelessly. "Your Veneration, would it be permitted that I speak to the prisoner?"
"Asconian law," said the Grand Master coldly, "allows no communication with a condemned man."
Mentally, Ponyet held his breath. "Your Veneration, I ask you to be merciful towards a man's soul in the hour when his body stands forfeit. He has been separated from spiritual consolation in all the time that his life has been in danger. Even now, he faces the prospect of going unprepared to the bosom of the spirit that rules all." This book is continued on cassette number 5, side 1.